Hello, friends. Welcome to the 47th installment of the ongoing catastrophe men call Spider on the Web. Brought to you, like all its predecessors, under Creative Commons license. No derivatives, non-commercial. If your hands up in the air and say, what? It has come to my attention that Spider on the Web number 44 was truncated. Nearly a third of its substance is missing. It chops off right after Frank Zappa's final guitar solo, performed in Budapest on June 30th, 1991. That was Frank's last public performance ever, jamming with a gypsy jazz band at the request of the mayor of Budapest. You missed, however, chapter 7 of my novel Very Hard Choices, which followed Frank's guitar solo. This is a problem I've been having with the software I'm using to record this sucker, and of course there is an upgrade, an update that fixes the problem, and it doesn't work on my version of the operating system, and I can't upgrade my operating system until I free up some disk space, and you don't want to hear about it. The point is, this happens every so often, and usually I have time to listen to the whole damn podcast all the way through before I post it. That particular week I didn't. My apologies. I will read you the missing chapter 7 this week. But first, here's one of my favorite songs by James Raymond, a live version of One for Every Moment by CPR, Crosby, Pivar, and Raymond. One of the very finest musical aggregations that David Crosby has ever been associated with, and I understand what a sweeping statement that is. I'd like to send this out to Joellen Day of Tennessee, who's currently undergoing more than hers or anybody's share of pain, and not for the first time. Please keep her in your prayers. One for Every Moment.
Just in case you didn't catch those names of the guys, that's Jeff Pivar playing guitar. Stephen DeStanislaw. Andrew Ford. And my son, James Raymond. And this is a song of James's called One for Every Moment.
Right Here a Little Late is Chapter 7 of Very Hard Choices by Spider Robinson. You'll recall that Chapter 6 finally brought our hero Russell Walker to his friend Xandor Zuniniego's high-tech hideaway on the tiny little Coveney Island off the coast of British Columbia, leaving behind his antagonist, a CIA agent using many names, currently calling himself McKinnon, who is presently on Russell's own home island, Heron Island, B.C., Without further ado, Chapter 7, Saturday, June 23rd, 2007, Bug Cove, Heron Island, British Columbia, Canada. McKinnon's state-of-the-art, top-of-the-line GPS receiver had a bad earphone jack. So even though he was very hungry for breakfast by now and wanted coffee very much indeed, he had to stay in the car if he wanted to keep on monitoring the conversation taking place. It never occurred to him not to. In similar situations in the past, he had gone hungry for days, gone without peeing for a day, remained motionless in the sun for hours. Years ago. He concentrated hard on what turned out to be nothing much, which is a classic first step to the hypnotic state. The conversation started out with an interesting sentence or two, but nearly at once it wandered off into nothing but meandering, meaningless chatter between the two males, which his target seemed prepared to let go on forever. Could Canada really be such a sissy place that even female police officers were too self-effacing to interrupt men talking? Or was she simply too busy smoking the pot they'd mentioned? The men's voices were remarkably alike, and they were so far from the mic he had to strain to make out what they were saying, and when he did it never turned out to be worth the trouble, and he didn't even realize he had fallen asleep until the first crack of thunder and avalanche of rain arrived together. When they did, his first thought was that he'd had a stroke. The truth made him little happier. He had never fallen asleep on stakeout before. It rattled him. Might have frightened him a little if it had had time. First things first, the conversation was over. Obviously, they had gone inside to wait out the rain. The GPS snitch said it had not moved a centimeter from its last known position. He could probably expect them to stay inside until the rain at least moderated, so he would have time to play back the conversation he'd just dozed through. Once he had dealt with second things. Now he was starving for breakfast and desperate for coffee, and his bladder was about to burst. The last problem was easiest to deal with, thanks to the heaviness of the rain. Anyone still outdoors would have better things to do than gawk at cars in a parking lot. He opened his door, swiveled on his seat, and planted both shoes on the ground as if he intended to get out, and urinated between his feet. By the time he was as close to done as he felt he absolutely needed to be, and could swing back inside and slam the door, he was soaking wet from the knees down, and both his shoes were overflowing. He removed them, tipped water out of each, removed his socks, and wrung them out. He did his best to wring out his pant legs, but was not willing to remove them to do a proper job, because he had seen too many comedies use that setup to introduce a policeman. He started the car, forced himself to wait patiently while the engine warmed, then set heat and fan to max, and arranged all the fan grills he could to aim at either his ice-cold calves or his sodden shoes and socks. It gave him plenty of time to consider his other problems. He could carry the GPS receiver around with him as long as he kept it dry, and it didn't need headphones to work as an alarm. It was smaller than an iPod. He could set it so that if the target's vehicle started up, or another started nearby, or there was loud conversation, the receiver would imitate the sound of a ringing cell. No one thought anything of it if you shut the phone off inside your pocket without bothering to take it out. So it was safe to go find caffeine and food in that order. And about time. Dear God, it was nearly 5 p.m. He had not fallen asleep so much as passed out from hunger. He could not have articulated why that was less dismaying, but it was. He found a way to fit his socks over two of the dashboard grills and turn them into warm wind socks, held his shoes before two others. Waiting for everything to dry, for the first time he had spare attention to notice that he had a vicious pulsing headache, so powerful it ran halfway to his shoulder blades, as if yearning toward the duller but deeper ache below in the muscles of his lower back. "It serves me right," he thought darkly, "not only for passing out on a stakeout, but for not at least admitting it to myself and putting the damn seat back first." By the time everything was dry enough to put back on, he was speaking to his own blood sugar, telling it that it wasn't the boss of him, and close to doing so aloud. He thought about accessing the net with his phone and googling up a decent restaurant, then realized he was being silly. There wouldn't be any, nor any shortage of mediocre ones near the ferry ramp and marina. He put his shoes and socks back on, got his top on and over his head, popped the trunk, got out into the rain and looked inside it, saw no umbrella, cursed the car's owner, turned at once on his heel and set off uphill on what appeared to be not only the village's main, but its only street. Nearly at once, his luck took a sharp turn for the better. The first business establishment he encountered, only 100 meters or so after leaving the marina lot, was a restaurant. That, at least, was his first assessment. As he neared the door, a number of subliminal signals caused him to revise it to a very good restaurant. Because an overhang kept him dry enough, he took a moment to glance at the small, discreet menu in the window, and nearly at once knew that somehow, absurdly, he had stumbled onto an excellent restaurant in the middle of nowhere. There were only 4 main courses offered. He was nearly drooling as he entered. He was nearly weeping as he left. Colinzia Verna's was not a mere excellent restaurant, but one of only 3 genuinely great ones he had ever been privileged to worship at. By polite inquiry, he learned that a culinary genius, chef at a Vancouver restaurant so good McKinnon had heard of it called Bishop's, had tired of the urban rat race and decided to move to the country for a while instead. Her husband ran the restaurant with equal genius while Carol cooked with a baby on her hip. Few on the island could afford their prices, but those who could seldom ate anywhere else. And those who couldn't, McKinnon learned, could usually afford to buy prepared frozen dinners and microwave them at home, accepting, or failing to notice, that this reduced their quality from sublime to merely superb. Sublime food is good for thinking. By the time he finished his appetizer, he realized his target might well be here for the night, in which case so was he. Ideal in several ways. He could take the target's own vehicle back to the mainland and abandon it somewhere near the border. The question was, should he bother to stay here above radar in some motel or B&B, or was it better to just find a quieter place near his target to park unobserved until daybreak? The answer depended in part on whether such a quiet place existed. He bought 2 frozen entrees for takeout without even thinking about it, a brisket of beef and mustard gravy with mashed and a butter chicken with rice, confident that he would be hungry again at least twice before either could spoil, and had an engine block for a stove. It took nearly all the American cash he had left on him, but he could not bear to stiff such an artist with a Fugazi credit card. An hour had passed by the time he got back to his car, so the ferry line was exactly as he had left it, just getting long enough to disappear around the curve at the distant top of the hill. The rain had not changed in intensity either. But the sun was nearly down now, and the street lights came on as he set his frozen dinners on the passenger seat beside him. Thinking about his bogus credit card had reminded him that his identity might be melting already, and surely would eventually. He lost no time in driving toward the location of the target's vehicle. He lost a fair amount of time in finding it, however. A GPS fix is only as accurate as someone has paid to make it, and nobody with a big checkbook was interested in Heron Island. More than one road his locator confidently told him to take turned out not to exist. One was a 50-meter-long driveway serving 3 small cottages. It was close to 8 o'clock by the time he drove slowly past the driveway where his target's car was parked. He couldn't see it through the trees and brush. This driveway seemed to be hundreds of meters long, but his locator was sure. A rural postbox station just past it offered a convenient place and excuse to pull over and think the situation over. So far, he'd seen no good prospects for an overnight hideaway. Lots of tempting dirt roads, but any of them could lead to the cabin of some paranoid hermit, and if they went nowhere, kids probably used them at night for social purposes. He'd seen no municipal lots with buses or trucks to hide behind. Not even one big snowplow. Wasn't this Canada? A chain motel seemed like his best choice, or failing that, a B&B. Apple Computer had recently stunned the world by releasing a breakthrough phone which was nearly as good as his own. He used it now to access the net. So it took him less time to learn that Heron Island had no motels, chain or otherwise, and only a single B&B with the sense to have a URL or a listing with Google, than it took him to marvel over the information. He phoned the B&B before he was quite finished, was able to make a reservation for that evening, and smiled when Mrs. Mead, the owner, cautioned him that he must be there to pick up his key before 9 o'clock, when she went to bed. He agreed he would. Well, he had just over an hour to reach a place at most 15 minutes away. If he came back later, the rain might just stop aiding reconnaissance, but if it did, the sound of his car would carry a long way and would be an unusual sound after the last ferry of the day. How would he explain to Mrs. Mead his being soaked to the skin on arrival? Who said he had to? God damn it. He shut the engine, restarted it in neutral with the parking brake engaged so that it would idle without lights, disabled the overhead light, and got out of the car. He looked longingly at the driveway, entered the woods. It was still early enough that his target might decide to go get in line for the last ferry of the night at any time. How was it, he wondered, that James Bond had never found himself in Africa in the rainy season, or in Bangladesh in monsoon season, or in the Pacific Northwest ever? He did have an umbrella, which he had seen carried into Colinzia Verna's by a man who had disrespected its food, but as he'd expected, it provided minimal help in the trees. He was wet pretty much everywhere below the diaphragm by the time he saw the lights. The way the terrain was laid out, he saw the two vehicles in the driveway before he had a good view of the house. The target's Honda, all right, and a recent Toyota just passed it. When he could see the house, he knew it was candy. He could walk in any time he liked and walk out with anything he wanted. A kid could. The same with the big tool shed or pottery studio or whatever the hell that adjacent outbuilding was. He couldn't understand people like that. Why have a house if it wouldn't keep bad guys out? It was like keeping a dog that wouldn't bite, or feeding a cat. Which, most unexpectedly, he did just then. A sudden shocking agony in his right ankle reached his attention simultaneously with the hallucinatory image of a light-colored, short-haired cat running away from him at full speed, backwards. Long training aided him in squelching a scream of pain and outrage. He was shocked to hear it anyway, and realized it was coming from the damned cat. As feral as himself by the sound of it, and territorial. Damn, here came again, sideways this time, but no less rapidly. There was no question in his mind that he could kick its head off. That might draw attention from inside the house. The cat squalling must be a common sound, the cat dying not so much. The truth was that he didn't want to. He identified. He temporized by slamming the umbrella against the ground just in time to make the cat abort its attack and panic. As it did, he saw that one of its eyes was solid white. That decided him. Before it could regroup, he turned and bugged out. One of the features his phone lacked was a flashlight. He risked using his to avoid breaking an ankle or leg. Or a hip, he reluctantly admitted to himself. Back in the car, breathing hard for the first time in entirely too long, he imagined what the major would have had to say about his performance. Routed by a cat. He staunched his bleeding with Kleenex from a box the previous Mr. McKinnon had tucked between the front seats, and found that he had lost about a quarter's worth of meat to the vicious little carnivore. Well, good for it. Pretty good for a critter that couldn't possibly have any depth perception. He glanced again at the Kleenex, checked the trunk, and found that the same thoughtful previous incarnation of himself kept a first aid kit back there. Okay, temporary setback. Go check in at... he shuddered. The Huron B&B before the window closed. Take a shower, dry his clothes, do a little web surfing without rain doing a drum roll just above his head. At midnight, park a reasonable distance away from this spot. Hike here in stolen rain gear nobody will have bothered to lock up, and walk down the center of that driveway bold as brass, prepared to meet any oncoming cat with a handful of buttered chicken in the snoot. Drift in and out of that house without waking anyone, and with a lot of information and any weapons or computer hard drives he encountered. Possibly return once more before dawn, move in, and commence interrogations. As he backed into the driveway to turn around and head back to the village, he caught himself humming the chorus of an old anti-war song by Graham Nash, and smirked as he remembered the words. It was good to have hope again. The car did seem a bit too noisy as he pulled away, but it wasn't going to be his car much longer. And he did keep automatic watch for a tail, from force of long habit, all the way to his B&B. But it did not occur to him that there weren't that many roads on Heron, or that after dark in such a rustic place he could be tailed by sound alone, almost as well as if there were an expensive GPS bug on his bumper. Nor that it is possible to drive with the lights off in a modern car, if you don't mind replacing the fuse when you're done. Okay, there ends Chapter 7 of Very Hard Choices. Before we skip ahead to where we left you last week with Chapter 12, I want to play another CPR song. I think these are some of the very best lyrics that David Crosby has ever written. I realize that's as ridiculously sweeping a statement as saying, this is my favorite Beatles song, but just listen to this. This goes out to Grace Raymond and to Django Crosby. It's called At the Edge.
A thing happens to you if you almost die and then have a child born. And then on top of that, another, you know, brilliant, fully grown son shows up and has your grandchild, bang, within 24 hours. His wife gave birth to their kid 24 hours after he met me. It's like he met his father, became a father, same day, you know. But a thing happens to me when I almost die and then I have a child born. And that is that you focus in on what matters. You become intensely conscious of what's truthfully really worth a damn and what isn't, you know. And At the Edge, I love because it talks about that.
Our grasp is so fragile, threaded so thin. I wonder each day if I'm blowing away. I know that I'm lucky, I wouldn't be here at all if somebody's hand hadn't been where I stand. At the edge of a very great fall, before you at the edge of the sea, a woman whose grip holds when you slip, but the darkness won't get to your family, won't go and make your heart light to where you know what is right. Go where you know you should go.
Bye.
I'm here to testify personally that David Crosby treats his friends very damn well indeed. Without further ado, Chapter 12 of Very Hard Choices by Spider Robinson. You'll recall that when last we saw Russell Walker, he had suffered a partial lung collapse, or pneumothorax, while paddling a kayak from Coveney Island to Heron Island off the coast of British Columbia, Canada, and had been rescued by the arrival of his friend the telepath Xandor Zudenigo, who was about to take him back home, despite the fact that Xandor can't stand to be within 50 yards of most people. Chapter 12, Saturday, June 23rd, 2007, Heron Island, British Columbia, Canada. I came out of my fugue without any sense of transition at the point where Heron Island grew close enough for decisions to need to be made. I breathed just a bit deeper than I had been, evaluated the pain, and was reassured it didn't seem any worse. I needed a spot where Zudi could bring us to shore, but encounter the absolute minimum possible number of people in the process. The prospects were as shitty as could be. It was a warm Saturday night in paradise. Every good place to land a boat was also a great place to make out. I felt Zudi's paddling rhythm falter momentarily at the thought. It might almost have made sense to have him head right into Bug Cove. The last ferry of the day had long since left by now. Downtown, such as it was, would be dead. The only place still open would be the pub, situated at least 500 meters uphill from the ferry ramp. But immediately to the south of the ferry terminus was the Bug Cove Marina, where about 100 boat people and their guests were sure to be awake. The best choice of a bad lot was the Yacht Club beach, nearly all the way around the island from where I wanted to end up. Heron Island teenagers all knew it was the only beach on the rock that the RCMP patrolled effectively and would roust them from. But there would probably be at least a few tourists or mainlanders, and to reach the shore we'd have to scull past a couple of dozen moored yachts, at least some of which would probably be occupied.
"By some of the richest sons of bitches on the island," Zudi said.
"What can I tell you?" Short pause.
"All right, which way?"
I visualized it, and he altered course appropriately. Long before I would have said it aloud, he heard me wondering, what's it like getting too close to another mind?
"Ever know someone who got migraines?"
"A couple of people, one of them real well. That bad?"
"Worse. A migraine plus a couple of abscessed teeth is close."
"Jesus."
"That's for one mind. It gets worse exponentially with each additional one."
"Dear God, how is it being this close to me?" He took a breather from paddling. When his breath regularized, he said,
"You're different. You always were. Even for a hippie, you were unusually tolerant. Non-judgmental. I don't know why. I mean, you put up with me as a roommate. I've always found that amazing. So did everyone on campus. Excuse me."
He fumbled around in his cockpit, came up with a bottle of water, drank deep. I remembered where he had shown me my own was stowed, but it was on my right, too far to reach across myself and get it with my left hand. A whole half-liter was way too much weight to risk lifting with my right. He handed his own water back over his shoulder, angling it so I could reach it easily with my left hand.
"Never thirst,"
he said, sounding as if he were quoting someone. I intended to take a small sip, but found myself drinking deep. It was delicious.
"But what amazes me far more," he said, "is that you're still the same 40 years later. You haven't hardened with age the way most people do. If anything, you're more tolerant than you were in college. You have fewer fixed opinions now than you did then. Even after a lifetime of acquiring the kind of embarrassments and regrets teenage boys can't begin to imagine, you're still okay with the idea of me walking around inside your head."
"You, I trust in there."
"I have..."
he began. He was silent then for at least a minute. Maybe two. Finally, he finished the sentence as if it had never been interrupted.
"Only been as flattered once, when Oxy chose to love me. I don't think I've ever been more deeply moved."
"So, answer the question, you ducked."
"Being this close to you is like having a bad headache."
Even as the sentence was leaving his mouth, we were both regretting it, because it made me laugh as he had meant it to, and you don't want to do that with a partial pneumothorax. But we also both knew the pain was minor, even reassuring in his minorness, and I mentally told him there was no need to apologize. He did anyway. A great blue heron went by on our right. Okay, to starboard. It was an impressive sight, even in the dark. God knows what he was doing out that late. Heron Island gets its name from the fact that it happens to contain one of exactly three great blue heron hatcheries in the lower mainland of British Columbia. There's another in Stanley Park in Vancouver, and I forget where the other one is.
I really like herons, Sudie said.
Me too.
I mean their minds. They're a lot easier to take than people.
You can read animals, too?
Not all. Some. And not as well, obviously. But I do get something more than just feelings and sensations from some. Several of the smarter bird species. Dolphins. Cats, of course, but anybody but a dog can read a cat's mind. Some dogs. Pigs. Pigs are smarter than most people imagine.
How about whales?
Whales are as smart as people, at least.
Jesus, can you...
No, they're as smart as we are, but they aren't remotely like us. We just don't have enough in common to learn each other's thought language. If I get close enough, I can hear them thinking and be aware that their thoughts are at least as sophisticated and structured and subtle and colored as my own. I just have no idea what any of it means. One of the things I've been doing with my time, since I came to this part of the world, is trying to identify the places where my worldview comes closest to agreeing with theirs, in hopes of one day establishing the basis for a kind of mental pigeon.
How's it going? He shrugged and resumed his paddling. So I resumed my plotting. I didn't have much to work with. Way too many unknowns. Almost nothing but... And I was juggling the most precious egg in my world. Okay, that was a start. Priority number one, keep Jesse alive and out of Guantanamo. Or worse. Priority two, keep Agent Pitt from getting his hands on Zudi by whatever means necessary. Priority three, keep Nika and me out of jail for murder. Or worse. Only priority three was optional. Zudi was following my tortured thoughts, of course, but kept his mouth shut and let me work the problem at my own speed. After you drop me off, Zudi, I want you to paddle back out as far as you need to and wait there. If you see a flashlight on the beach, blink 1, 2, pause 3. Come in as fast as you can and pick up Jesse. Then get him to the airport as fast as you can. If you don't see any flashlight by first light, take off and get your ass back home and tile the lodge. Do you still have that cell phone I gave you back then?
No, and you can't call my internet phone because it has no number. It's outgoing only. But you can email or instant message me when I'm home.
He gave me the necessary data and shut up. I kept thinking. A couple of useful ideas came to me, but I had no idea if or how I could put them into effect. Again, just too many unknowns. I was simply going to have to improvise. Against a trained CIA agent. It began to sink all the way in that I might in fact die tonight. And found myself thinking that everyone dies and that the natural end I could foresee for myself was one of the very bad deaths. Agent Pitt would almost certainly be both quicker and more merciful. Did that mean I was feeling suicidal? No, I was just assessing and accepting the stakes before placing my bet. If you want the truth, part of me was looking forward to the challenge of matching wits with a spook. How cool would it be if I actually managed to take him using nothing but brains? Most of my life I'd felt like I was the smartest guy in the room. Maybe it was time to find out how smart. If it killed me, well, there were worse ways to go, that's all. A little after 11:30, we finally came in sight of the dozen or two boats moored at the yacht club beach. Zudi paused in his paddling only momentarily. Perhaps he was just sounding the telepathic airwaves to try and pick out the least painful route for him. I mentally assured him that most of those people were probably going to be asleep, but he didn't bother to reply. We both knew it wasn't likely, not before midnight on a warm Saturday night in paradise. I could see it first begin to affect him when we were still over 500 meters from the nearest yacht. His breathing began to speed up. His paddling became less steady. I could see him hunch his shoulders and tense his neck like a man steeling himself against pain. He murmured something, then repeated it louder when I didn't catch it.
Alcohol makes it louder. Some drugs, too.
Try focusing on me.
Good idea, he said.
Three boats were visibly and unmistakably hosting parties, two of them into the raucous stage. Others were occupied, but less noisily so. Presumably those would contain the fewest and quietest minds. Zudi aimed that way, and from his involuntary physical responses I could tell it wasn't working out as well as he'd hoped. As we approached within 50 meters of a large boat that seemed empty, or at least dark, quiet, and buttoned up for the night, he began to moan softly. Then, without warning, he spun his head to the left away from the boat, vomited with great force, and changed course to miss it as widely as possible. He was able to close his teeth and lips on the moan, but not to stop it, and his paddling began to falter. Maybe this will sound stupid, but I tried to be me as hard as I could, to think as loud as possible. He stopped moaning.
"Thanks,"
he said, just loud enough for me to hear. The current was strong this close in, and blindly determined to frustrate him, sweeping him the way he didn't want to go. As his stroke was weakening, each one did him less good. The distance between us and the dark devil boat was widening, but just barely and not fast enough. I took out my paddle.
"No,"
he groaned, but I ignored him. My right arm was all but useless, but my right hand worked as well as ever. I made it into an oar lock and rode the paddle like an oar with my left arm. If I timed it just right with my breathing cycle, it didn't hurt a bit. Well, not a bite. It added some velocity, enough that we finally pulled far enough away for Zudi to start recovering. "That bad?" His answer was a shaky whisper.
"That man is vile."
"Worse than Alan?"
"Good God, no. No, he's only a man. But as bad as men get."
"Who?"
"Never mind. Just thank you, Russell."
That was all I could get out of him on the subject. There were two other boats we had to pass that gave him some trouble, but not as bad, and then we had run the gauntlet. He seemed to regain strength as we reached the shallows, and when we had approached the beach close enough to hear it, he suddenly poured on the coals and then somehow executed a maneuver strikingly like the bootlegger turn Jim Rockford used to do in his tan Firebird once every episode, so that we hit the sand stern first.
"Show off. Sit tight."
He climbed out of his cockpit and helped me get out of mine without hurting myself too badly. No companion so thoughtful as a telepath. But he was not as much help as I'd expected him to be. Even those stevedore's arms of his had to be tired after nearly 2 hours of paddling, of course, but it was more than simple fatigue. That last 500 meters had sapped him. "Are you sure you can make it back out again?" I asked aloud. He shrugged.
"What if I said no?"
"I'd get back in, help you make it back out, and go to Plan B. I just thought of it, see?"
"You thought of it an hour ago and rejected it. It's terrific for me and no good at all for you."
He was right, of course. The Japanese Buddhist monk Oriyoki Kondo had absolutely no neighbors because his stark little minimalist sketch of a cabin was in a preposterous location at the base of a rough, near-vertical hillside accessible only by boat or by a long and extremely gnarly path that switchbacked its way down the slope from a municipal hiking path that led to paved roads. Best of all, Yoke was sure to be away now on his annual pilgrimage to a monastery in Osaka. Zudi could land me there in perfect comfort and safety, tie up to Yoke's bare-bones dock, and await further events in peace. Then all I'd have to do was climb a very steep hill without completely collapsing my lung, in the dark, without a flashlight, on a path I'd taken a total of maybe 5 times all in daylight, and then be left with an even longer walk to my place than the one I was facing now.
"This way is only medium crappy for both of us. I promise I'll get your boy on a plane to New York if he shows up. Good luck, Slim."
He shoved the kayak off, boarded it like Hopalong Cassidy, and began paddling like mad. Slim is not the first nickname I ever had, but it was the first one I ever liked, and Zudi was the one who gave it to me, and kept using it until everyone else did.
"Good luck, Xandor."
With no idea whether it helped or not, I stood there at the water's edge, being me as loud as I could, until he had made it safely all the way through the minefield. I could barely see him wave his paddle. I waved back with my good arm. Then I turned around and allowed myself to think about what lay before me. The path that leads up from the Yacht Club beach to the small gravel parking lot isn't that steep, but it's long, and sand all the way, hard to walk in. Trucked-in sand, like the beach itself. Heron Island has no natural sandy beaches. The road the parking lot leads to is asphalt, a more reasonable walking surface. But its first 100 meters or so are way steeper than the path up from the beach, a higher grade than provincial or city codes would have permitted, and it doesn't entirely level off for nearly half a click. If I had to guess, I'd say that in ideal circumstances, as fit as I ever get, rested, and with two fully inflatable lungs, it would have taken me perhaps 2.5 to 3 minutes to walk from the shore all the way up to level ground, depending on how many times I chose to stop along the way, and I'd have arrived sweaty and breathing aerobically, feeling it in my calves. It took me about 10 minutes, and there were a couple of times I honestly doubted I'd make it, and I arrived soaked with sweat, wishing I could spare the breath to sob, feeling pain riding the sciatic nerves all the way up my legs to my lower back. I wanted badly to sit down and rest, but I knew how hard it would be to get back up again. So I picked out a sturdy tree a few meters from the road, leaned back against it very carefully, and let it hold me up until I felt ready to continue. Not soon. Finally, I lurched back out onto blacktop and resumed walking home. Level ground lasted no more than 200 or 300 meters. It came back from time to time, but not often for much longer than that. Every road on Heron Island is a roller coaster to one degree or another for most of its length, and one in particular was clearly designed by God specifically to kill bicyclists and joggers. My route home that night was not that bad, but I feel confident in saying it was the second worst possible because I gave it a lot of thought as I walked, replayed each road on the rock in my mind in detail, and compared them. For some reason, it seemed important to quantify exactly how bad my luck was running tonight. For some other reason, when the answer came back almost as shitfully as possible, rather than minding, I took a weird kind of comfort in it. Even on Heron Island, there are usually at least a few cars on the road at night on a Saturday night, but I was on the least traveled road, and furthermore, I seemed to have precisely hit that golden period during which everybody who wanted to party was already there, and nobody was ready to go home yet. Ordinarily, that walk home would have taken perhaps 45 minutes. That night it took more than 2 hours, each of them composed of longer-than-usual minutes. I was born with bubbles on the surface of my lungs, called blebs, much like the bubbles on a bald inner tube. Nobody knows why. Every so often, for mysterious reasons or none at all, one of those bubbles pops and the tire starts to go flat. As the lung collapses, it pulls away from the inner wall of the thorax, leaving a vacuum, which promptly begins filling with blood and other bodily fluids. That hurts even more than it sounds like it does, and encourages further collapse. At worst, it stops about halfway, but if it gets that bad, you're in for a lengthy hospitalization involving procedures you don't want to hear about and I don't want to think about. Fortunately, 30 years ago, a surgeon at Bellevue Hospital in New York did a procedure I also won't describe, and since that time, I've never had a collapse worse than 5 or 10%, which only means a few days in bed and a week or two of feeling frail and moving carefully. 3 decades later, I can still vividly remember exactly how painful that operation and its aftermath were. Beyond belief, let's leave it at that. I only learned about 10 years ago, by accident, that it is considered one of the most painful procedures a human is likely to survive. Nobody at Bellevue thought to tell me that. For 20 years I believed I was just more of a coward than other people. To this day I can't bear to be touched on or near the scar, which runs from my right nipple almost all the way back to my spine, even though it can hardly be seen anymore. That is why pain in my chest is my worst nightmare. Reason has nothing to do with it. My animal body knows that its lungs once caused it an eternity of unendurable horror and believes they might again at any time. My son was at risk. My friend Nika's career and freedom were in great jeopardy. Mine, too. Reason had nothing to do with it. I kept on walking through the dark. So my chest hurt. Big deal. Every time I passed a driveway, especially one with light visible through the trees, I fantasized giving up, knocking on the door at the end of it and begging whoever was inside for a ride. I just couldn't come up with a fantasy in which my explanation for why I needed one sounded remotely plausible even to me. Keep walking, Russell. Remember to alternate feet. Because the problem was I didn't need a ride to my home or even to my driveway. I needed a ride to no closer than 0.5 kilometer from my home. There was no way of knowing where Agent Pitt was right now, so I had to assume he was in my home right this minute, rummaging through my underwear drawer in search of maps to Zudi's place. If so, I did not want him to hear a vehicle stop at the end of the driveway, make a U-turn, and go away. Keep walking. Oh, wow, look there, a garbage can as old as I am, metal instead of plastic, just tall enough to sit on, and the lid is flat.
Sit. Rest a minute. Or two. I needed to connect with my son, one driveway short of mine, just as quietly as possible, and find out from him whether my house was still safe to approach. And if so, send him to burgle that damned incriminating laptop at once while I stood watch near the end of the driveway. Armed with, say, a shovel that I could swing left-handed, maybe two or three times tops. Back on your feet. Keep walking. If it was too late, if Pitt had already tossed the place or was there now, well, I could ask Jesse to hit me with the shovel and put me out of my misery. It probably wouldn't take much persuading. Bad upgrade. Throttle back from slow to ultra-slow. Listen to chest. Maybe I would get lucky and find Nika, too, lurking in my neighbor Doug's barn. Lena might have insisted on waiting around for her, and then if clocking out took Nika less time than she'd feared, Lena could have gotten her back to Heron by about now. Pause until pain subsides. And even if Lena had dropped her off and come right home, Nika might have been able to clock out fast and then rent or charter something with enough muscle to beat Lena back here. She might have Agent Pitt in handcuffs right now. Keep walking. Or she might have found herself saddled with emergency overtime duty of some sort and be stuck on the mainland overnight. Or worse. Bad downgrade. Downshift from ultra-slow to half that. Car! Walk backwards, stick out thumb, smile ingratiatingly. Dive into roadside brush, barely in time, fortunately landing on left side. Get up. Curse drunken louts. Resume walking. Chapter 13. Outside Time and Space. It went like that forever. I can't remember how many times I had to stop altogether and wait for the pain to recede, at least once on every upgrade. I do remember very clearly giving up three separate times, just despairing entirely and sitting down somewhere to await the heat death of the universe. I only remember changing my mind the first time. The other two, I simply found myself in motion again with no memory of having decided to be. At some point, I came unstuck from reality and seemed to be walking through an unedited highlights reel of my own life. Times and places, and especially people from my past, came and went randomly, completely out of sequence. Xerox, for instance. There was a time when I could have told you what Xerox's real name is, but it's long gone from memory after all these years. Something Hindu and very long and barely pronounceable is all I can recall now. But the man himself, I don't think I'll ever forget. For some reason, he made a lasting impression on me. The first thing he said to me was, "Please call me Xerox, my excellent friend. I have renamed myself after one of my greatest heroes." At that time, Xerox Corporation was probably the biggest runaway stock market success story since the Depression. Its revenues had risen from chum change to more than $500 million in 8 years. I do not know if my friend Xerox thought the company had been founded by someone of that name, or if it was the company itself he admired. But I am quite certain that if he's still alive today, he's doing precisely whatever it is he wants to be doing, successfully, in style, and with huge gusto. This will sound ridiculous if you're not as old as I am, but trust me, back in the 60s, things got so weird that even genuinely caring parents, like the ones I was lucky enough to have, could find themselves telling their beloved son he was no longer welcome in their home until he cut his hair short again. So by 1967, I was spending my holidays, semester breaks, and summer vacations hiding out on campus at William Joseph College, rather than accept symbolic castration. When the administration caught me at it that summer, we worked out a deal where I earned my keep by doing odd jobs, and the first one I got was the weirdest, human fire alarm. The Marionite order that ran old Billy Joe had just constructed a small new dormitory that year specifically for foreign students, of whom they'd accepted a large number at inflated rates, and of course the building wasn't ready when the new year approached. Most of the things it lacked—hot water, heat, windows—would merely be vast lingering inconveniences for the new inhabitants, but one lack in particular was really important even in the school's eyes—a fire alarm system. Without one, the building could not legally open. State law forbade it. So they hired me to walk around the building, looking for fires. 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, for a total of nearly 3 months. Even at minimum wage, it added up to a tidy sum, enough to keep me in marijuana for the next 2 semesters. Minimum wage in 1967 was something like $1.20 an hour.
but a gallon of gas cost 28 cents, and an average new home went for $40,000. Marijuana was then commonly sold in quarter ounces called nickel bags because they cost $5. You could buy a pound of excellent weed for $100, or a kilo for two. I can no longer recall what hashish went for then. I just remember that I got an incredible deal from Xerox. Most of the international students that first year were dirt poor there by the grace of God or scholarship. Xerox seemed, if anything, more affluent than any of the American-born students. When he walked the campus, he somehow gave the impression of wearing spats and swinging a walking stick. Girls went crazy for him, even though he was short and dark and had a face like a foot and spoke with an accent thicker than that of Apu, the Quickie Mart owner. Guys forgave him for it because of his extraordinary hash, of which he seemed to have an inexhaustible supply. He shared a bowl with me the night we met and roared with laughter at my explanation of what I was doing there. It was good stuff. I found myself telling him about my weird roommate Smelly and my problems with my old lady. He told me about his politics and his mother. And finally we had reached a level of stoned intimacy at which even I, a good American hippie white boy terrified of accidentally saying something racist, felt comfortable asking him what it had been like to grow up well off while surrounded by so much abject poverty. He laughed so hard he spilled the pipe and burned a hole in the one blanket Billy Joe had so far found for him. He had grown up in Bombay, as Mumbai was called back then, poorer than poor, not just broke like everybody else, but without family. He had no idea who his parents were or what might have happened to them. There was nobody to ask. Nobody raised him. He did it himself. How? I naturally asked. He wasn't sure. He said his earliest memories were of running a protection racket that covered three streets, using hired 8-year-olds as muscle. That had brought him to the amused attention of a local crime lord named Yama, who took him under his wing and bullied him into learning English.
"Big mistake Lord Yama made," Xerox said, passing me the generously refilled pipe, "was to tell me just how great a gift he was giving me, how much people paid for English lessons. Those who tutored the children of the rich, he told me, were paid more than even a good thief could make."
He grinned like a hungry hyena.
"He was right. I stayed with him for nearly 6 years, learning many useful things, but only until I could pass for a teenager most excellently. Then I got my first job as a tutor of English, and that year earned more money than Yama had paid me in 6. The work was also much easier and much safer. In 3 years, I was lending money to Yama."
He stuck out his chin proudly.
"Bombay is home to the Bombay Stock Exchange, the National Stock Exchange of India, and the Reserve Bank of India. I am the only person in this international student's building who has paid his tuition and expenses out of his own pocket every penny. I even offered to pay for 4 years in advance, but the college was unwilling to gamble so on the American economy."
"I didn't realize they were that smart," I said, and passed him the pipe I now had going well. "But tell me something, Xerox. How did you ever manage to promote yourself that first tutoring gig without any credentials you could show? I mean, you couldn't put graduate of Lord Yama's Academy for Young Men on a resume."
"That would not have been prudent, no," he agreed, and took a few hits before continuing. "Instead, I went with my greatest strength. Bullshit."
"How?"
"I saw a very wealthy person indeed in a park, watching his children being given an English lesson by their tutor, a fat smug fool. I went up to this wealthy man, bowed to him with greatest respect, and said, 'Oh, sir, I am non-manically gormented by the dumpacity of your genius.' And then I walked away before he could be replying. Before long, the wealthy person comes after me. My children's tutor did not know half the words you used, so I have fired the fool. Would you tell me, please, what means I am normanically governmented by whatever you said?" "Certainly, sir," I say. "I will tell you exactly what it means. It means that if you hire me to replace that fool, I will teach your children a great deal more than just grammar and vocabulary, all for the same price." For 10 seconds I thought I was a dead man. Then his frown became a smile, and I knew I would be attending college in the United States of America.
Thinking of Xerox helped. I'd told Jesse about him more than once while he was growing up. Xerox's was just the kind of insane, dogged confidence I needed now, all right. I wonder what he was up to now. I'm out of time, folks. Just got time to thank you very much for your subscriptions and PayPal donations. I can't tell you how much that's been helping my cash flow in these troubled times. And please don't forget that you can buy Very Hard Choices in Bain Books hardcover and better bookstores everywhere, And Blackstone Audio has just released my reading of Stardance by Spider and Jeannie Robinson, and any minute now we'll be releasing Starseed and Starmine. Check them out, too. Outrageously, CPR's albums are out of print. There are used copies available at Amazon.com. To learn more about the group, go to www.crosbycpr.com. Now, to take us out of here, here's David Crosby again with another of his very finest songs and unquestionably his shortest. He's joined partway through by his good friend Graham Nash and his oldest son, James Raymond. Here from the 2004 double CD Crosby Nash is David Crosby with Samurai.
Spirit son of a samurai, tilting at windmills, a misfit in this century. He was looking for a living to be proud of. Well, he was driven before a dozen winds at once, like a salmon jumping upstream without the fish's sense not to wander. Well, he was carrying his baggage chained to his feet, his weapon held across his eyes. He was looking for the light. He was looking for the light. Well, he was the only one I met on the road last night.